So, Bill, today we're talking about turning plants into ethanol. What do you think of that?
I think I'll have another beer about that.
Okay, it's not for consumption. That was a couple weeks ago when we talked about brewing beers. Actually, you know, cellulosic, let me try that again, ethanol, you know, for fuel.
Great.
You don't sound too excited.
No, I do. I think that's a great idea, and I think it's good to have people working on it.
Specifically, we're going to be talking to Jeremy Smith, who's with University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and the Oak Ridge National Lab, who will use not only one of the world's largest supercomputers, but one of the world's largest sources of neutrons to figure out how to get plants to turn into cellulose.
And he's got a really quirky southern accent, too.
Right, so really big resources brought to bear to figure out why plants don't want to be turned into gasoline. Mm-hmm. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
I'm from X, and we're talking to real smokers about quitting. Tell me when you smoke and why you smoke.
First thing I do in the morning is get some coffee and have a cigarette.
If I have a cup of coffee, I gotta have a cigarette.
As soon as I wake up.
Okay.
With coffee, after I eat, and in between snacks.
Okay.
When I'm bored.
Pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
Have you tried to quit?
I quit for 3 months, went out one night, bought a pack of cigarettes, and that was the end.
I've actually tried to quit cold turkey, and that's really hard.
You ever hear about stories like, and then he threw the pack out the window, and he never smoked again?
Now, I've actually heard a guy throw a pack out the window, but he went to go buy another pack.
What would you do different?
Actually having a plan and thinking it through.
It's like you have to relearn yourself not to smoke, especially at times when you really know this is the time I have the cigarette, like in the morning after coffee.
You have to relearn how to live your life without a cigarette in your hand.
With the right plan, you can quit smoking. Free at becomeanx.org. X, a new way to think about quitting. Brought to you by X and the Ad Council.
All the best and craziest electronic music. Tune in every Wednesday evening here on WRAK Atlanta from 7 to 9 p.m. to the Mobius.
Join your host, Matt and Josh, on a space ride through future fun. From industrial to IDM, from noisecore to bitrock, dub, ambient, and everything in between.
We feature in-studio sets, live interviews, and recorded mixes from the finest in local, national, and international electronic music.
Focused on everything from labels such as Warp, Schematic, Merc, and all sorts of net labels to suit your synth fancy.
That's every Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. All your electronic music needs, the Mobius here on WREK.
The home of true quality diverse music.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ledovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever effervescent co-host, a man who every time he eats Mexican food refers to it as an extinction level event, Bill Hunt.
No, that's just the people in my family. My family refers to it as extinction.
I'm sorry. I had to go cheap sophomoric bathroom humor. I just felt that's right.
Yeah.
Ever since last week's Helper Monkey episode.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that was the robot for $35,000. It's the Helper Monkey.
Right. I mean, now I think we all want a helper monkey more than we want a robot.
I do, yeah.
All right, so on to serious stuff. The title of today's program is Why Plants Don't Want to Be Turned into Gasoline. Frankly, I don't blame them because I don't want to be turned into gasoline either. Right. You, I could go either way on
that. You're closer to being able to turn you into gasoline, though, than cellulose, but we'll talk
about that. But look, with all the hair gel in your hair, I think you're already 30% hydrocarbon.
I'm a living petroleum byproduct,
All right, today's guest is Dr. Jeremy Smith. Now, Jeremy, correct me on this. You hold a governor's chair at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and are also the director of the Center for Molecular Biophysics at the Oak Ridge National Lab. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Thanks very much for the invitation to be on the show.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you. And you specialize in computational molecular biophysics, which really has to impress people at cocktail parties. I'm thinking.
You get that glazed look come over pretty quickly.
Right, yeah.
But then you say something like, well, that's what helps people to figure out that DNA was a double helix.
Oh, is that what they say to you?
And then people say, oh, yes, some of them know it's a double helix.
But, right.
Yeah. Wow. And you have your research places a special emphasis on computer simulation of the biological molecules, but you are also very interested in characterizing that structure, and I'm assuming that's for comparison to the computer simulation, because I do computer simulation, and very often it's fantasy land unless we can actually reproduce an experimental quality. And for that, you specifically use neutron scattering.
Yeah, that's right. These computer simulations, they're very pretty. They make nice graphics, you know, that we show to people on big screens and stuff. But sometimes the simulations can just wander off into fantasy land.
Right, right.
And so you have to check them out and make sure that the things that the simulations are doing represent reality somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And we use neutrons to help understand that.
Right, and I guess today we're calling you our nomad researcher because you've led research groups in, what, France, Germany, and the United States?
That's right. That's
and, of course, you're from England, so what's the deal? Did you leave those countries willingly, or did the authorities ask you to leave?
Well, I left England because there was no sun one summer, and I was fed up with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is tough.
So I went to France and spent some time in France and realized that if you try and do anything in France, the answer is always no. Unless you talk to the lady very nicely about her family for about half an hour, and then you make, then the answer is yes.
Oh, okay.
So instead I went to Germany, where I found out that you can do certain things if it follows exactly the order that they have, yeah? This is a country of order.
Yes, right. Alles ist in Ordnung. I lived in Switzerland for a while,
so
I'm very familiar with that concept.
But then the time came, you see, where I got a call from my landlord. I was renting an apartment, who said that he was not happy with me because my curtains at the window, they were neither closed nor open, they were half open. This doesn't fit the order, you see.
Was this in Germany?
In Germany, that's right.
Oh, yeah. I thought Switzerland was bad.
But he either wants you to see you undress or not at all. He doesn't want to get tempted. Seeing half, I saw you put your shorts on and nothing. I couldn't see anything after that.
So I moved to the United States, where, of course, everything is possible.
Right. Wow. And I think most Americans aren't familiar with that. I mean, when I lived in Switzerland, and my friend Greg Rutledge, who's on the faculty at MIT now, we were looking for an apartment. And like most, you know, grad students, we were going to share an apartment because you save money. That's when I learned the word Wohngemeinschaft in the northern part of Switzerland. You know, communal living group. They thought we were a bunch of, they either thought we were gay or a hippie commune. I'm not sure which one it was. But yeah, they like things in order there. Well, we're glad
These Wohngemeinschafts, these WG as they're called, this is typically what you do when you're 45 years old and get divorced.
Oh, okay.
That you go straight into a WG with a bunch of other men. It looks rather funny.
So no wonder they were surprised. All right, so I'm at that age now, so I'll be looking into this in Europe. Let me write that down. Wohngemeinschaft.
So do you speak French, German, English, and American?
French, German, English, and American. I'm just starting to learn redneck now.
Oh, there you go.
You know, the word is... Do you know what mayonnaise is, mayonnaise?
No.
Mayonnaise, a lot of women in here. Yeah?
Very good.
I'm trying to get that right.
I would recommend watching Blue Collar Comedy Tour. I think you can pick up a lot of the language directly from there. And I could help. I'm bilingual. I speak American and Southern.
Right, he's from Mississippi.
Yeah, so I can speak a little bit of both. So,
but let's not knock that. Jeff Foxworthy was an alumnus of Georgia Tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was here for 2 years,
right.
That may explain a lot.
Right.
All right. So, I guess question. So, you basically do work in physics, chemistry, and biology. What's your actual academic training in?
Yeah, physics, chemistry, biology, computer science, and mathematics.
Wow.
The training is I did a first degree in biophysics, which was the only one that they had in England at the time. It was up in the cold north in Leeds. And that basically was just studying physics, chemistry, maths, and biology at the time, yeah?
Wow. Hmm.
So you mix them all up, but you miss out the bits that are not really relevant for biological systems, like the standard model of the universe in physics and analytical chemistry and things like that. They're bits missed out, you know?
Oh, okay. Wow. And I only ask you that because I think a lot of our listeners don't realize how fundamentally collaborative modern science is. And there's a lot of this weird, I started here and I ended up here kind of stuff. And that's good, I think, for science.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great struggle that scientists have, is to understand each other
mm-hmm.
when
right.
you're in different disciplines.
Right.
Like
right.
In Heidelberg in Germany, where I used to be, I was in a mathematics institute. And there, understanding mathematicians can be very difficult sometimes. And
that can be very difficult here.
Yeah. So, you know, the administrators of science, they try and get us together. In other words, people from mm-hmm. different disciplines to work together, because they know that sometimes produces the most creative science.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then the people from the different disciplines, you know, we'd like to do that in principle, but... in practice, it's difficult to understand each other.
Right.
There's this stove piping in the organizations mm-hmm. as well
right.
that you have to somehow get over.
Right. All right. So before we get into the recalcitrance of plants wanting to be turned into gasoline, let's start, as we often do, with...
Science in the News.
And today we've got two Science in the News articles. The first one is just for Bill, because Bill mm-hmm. is a fan about talking about the standing wave patterns mm-hmm. acoustically in the vuvuzela.
Yeah.
Right? So,
yeah.
And this comes from across the pond, so maybe you can appreciate this one as well, Jeremy.
Should I do this in the background while you read this?
I don't know where I saw this on TV or something, but basically The Guardian, the BBC, the Associated Press, and Reuters report that the official list of things that folks in the UK are told not to bring to the Pope's upcoming visit include, well, they forbid candy. I don't get that. Candy, alcohol, barbecues, pets, musical instruments.
He's
specifically
a Catholic. He's a Catholic. Why not bring the alcohol?
Yeah, I was raised Catholic.
Yeah.
We embrace that. But
yeah.
The vuvuzela is prohibited. How do you feel about that, Bill?
Well, does the Pope, is he anti-vuvuzela or something like that?
I'm guessing nobody wants that droning sound. I'd rather have bagpipes being run over by a Land Rover in the background than the vuvuzela.
Yeah, I don't think it's the droning sound. I think it's that the vuvuzela actually poses a physical threat to others, you know, if you think of what you could do with it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not too frightened by a polypropylene tube.
You get hit in the back and neck with some spittle, you know, you don't know if you got the Ebola virus now.
But you think that's it? It's the use of it as a weapon?
No, I think it's just the annoyance factor. But I don't know why the Pope, the Pope's German, maybe he made a list of stuff that really ticked him off.
Okay, so sort of flying bomber and the vuvuzela.
Yeah, it sounds too much like the Luftwaffe. Maybe that's what it was.
All right, so on to the serious science in the news. It comes from our favorite writer of the New York Times, Gina Colada. I just want to call her Pina Colada.
Gina, I think her middle name is Pina.
All right, from the August 20th edition, that's just this past Friday, entitled Muscle Disease Traced to Revived Dead Gene. And I think this addresses something that I think it was way back in the 70s where we started talking about all these genes we didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we called it, you know, sort of junk DNA.
Junk DNA, yeah.
Yeah. And
they
didn't
understand it. They didn't know what it was. So the geneticists called it junk DNA.
Right. So over the years, we've learned that a lot of it may not be junk. There's a lot of on-off upregulation parts of it. A lot of it is dead genes. And in fact, we talked about this probably last year that Lactobacillus has a lot of dead genes for processing maltose and glucose and mannose. But it's really good with lactose, and this is how we make yogurt now out of milk.
Right.
So that's not really a problem. You can see it evolve. And that was literally only over a few thousand years that they saw that. But this article points out that the human genome, as we mentioned, is riddled with dead genes, fossils of a sort, dating back hundreds of thousands of years. The genome's equivalent of an attic full of broken and useless junk. Some of those genes, surprised geneticists reported Thursday, can rise from the dead like zombies. You ought to be able to that.
Okay.
Waking up to cause one of the most common forms of muscular dystrophy. This is the first time geneticists say that they have seen a dead gene come back to life and cause a disease. If we're thinking of a collection of genome's greatest hits, this would go on the list, said Dr. Francis Collins, a human geneticist and the director of the National Institute of Health. The disease, facio-capulohumeral muscular dystrophy, known as FSHD. We'll stick with FSHD. is one of the most common forms of muscular dystrophy, and it's known to be inherited in a simple pattern. But before the paper, which was published online Thursday in Science magazine by a group of researchers, this cause was poorly understood. So I just think that's amazing that what used to be called junk DNA now might be responsible for years of telethons by Jerry Lewis trying to address this.
Right.
Sort
if there,
of thing.
If the DNA had not been genes had not been turned off, we wouldn't have had to listen to all these telethons.
Right. And
that's
and
what you're saying.
Here's the thing to remember. You know, what are they? What's the term they always use? You know, where the science is well known, the science is settled science, right?
Not so much.
Gravity.
Conventional wisdom, yep.
Yeah,
yeah,
there,
gravity
yeah,
we're settled on. But
as
you know,
a friend of mine says, conventional wisdom seldom is.
Yeah, exactly. Conventional or wise.
Yeah.
And we're learning new stuff all the time. And I think the geneticists are excited because now they're thinking maybe coming back to life, formerly junk DNA, dead genes, might be responsible
for a lot
of
things.
That's
why you need to keep an open mind.
Right. And very exciting because it's muscular dystrophy.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
Right.
Okay. So now on to biofuels. So what exactly are biofuels? Is that where we're starting, Jeremy?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, biofuels, it's to do with energy independence. We'd like to get away from spending all this money on fossil fuels and on oil in particular from countries that we have problems with, and one of the ways to do that is to find alternative sources of energy, and biofuels is one of the alternative sources of energy. It's where we make fuel from biological systems, from plants in particular, and algae and things like that. That's what biofuels are, and there's some hope that we'll be able to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels by developing biofuels. And also that there'll be some environmental benefits as well.
But now, I think the real question is, you have lots of different biological sources of biomass. I mean, you mentioned algae, lots of different plants. Some are harder or easier to turn into something that we can use as a fuel, like ethanol.
Well, let me ask this first. So with the biofuels, are you specifically trying to get ethanol, or are there a class of chemicals?
Well, I think there are a range of different fuels that you can get from biological systems. The one that we're particularly interested in is ethanol, indeed, from cellulose. And I'd like to be able to tell you a bit more about that, if possible.
Sure.
Okay. Well, actually, before we go into those details, we're going to take a quick break. But to our listeners, if you've got a question or comment in the latter half of the show about using supercomputers and neutron scattering to figure out how to get plants to convert into ethanol, give us a call here if you're listening live Wednesday, noon to 1 at 404-894-2468. Once again, that studio number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back after this message on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
It's not hard to find the best reggae that Atlanta has to offer. Know your roots. Keep it simple. And tune in to 5446, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
Hi, professional skateboarder Tony Hawk here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have the energy to skate through anything.
Nice play on words, Doc.
That's how I roll, Bugs. So whether you like to work the half pipe,
now that's catching air.
Kick the soccer ball around, or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
For an hour a day.
The way you like to move, as long as you're moving.
Carve out some time every day and get active. Because it's time to do a 180 on what you think exercise is.
Because it can be whatever you want it to be. So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
At www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're chatting with Jeremy Smith about the production of ethanol from cellulose. So what is cellulose, and why are we interested in this as a source for making biofuels?
Well, cellulose is the major component of the plant cell wall. And what that means is the major component of plants. Most of plants is made of the cell wall and the cellulose. Mm-hmm. And so you can probably imagine that if we could convert all that cellulose into energy, we would be using up most of the plant that we are producing, and therefore it could be very efficient.
Right, right.
So one of the things, like in the Mississippi Delta for cotton growth, sometimes these cotton plants are like 15 feet high, and they harvest the cotton, but then the stalks, they just burn it or plow it under. Could that potentially be used as fuel?
Absolutely. Now, you may be aware that bioethanol is currently largely produced from corn.
Right.
And that's not so efficient because only small parts of the corn itself are used.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If we could use the cellulose, then it would be much, much more efficient.
You could use the corn cobs then, right?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, it's so efficient that there's virtually no net carbon production, so it'd be very good for global warming as well.
Mm-hmm. And the assumption of no net carbon production is that anything you produce from this, that carbon is going to get reincorporated back into the cycle via growing the plant again.
That's right.
Right.
That's the reason why. Yeah.
Yeah. Because Bill was giving me a helper monkey look on that.
No.
I mean, you're still producing a lot of CO2, but the CO2 then goes right back into the plant cycle. So it appears to me that you have thrown down the gauntlet here. Because a lot of other folks, if you look at corn, and you've got, smaller sugars that show up in this corn syrup type stuff, and if you look at what Brazil does, they produce a lot of ethanol. It comes from simpler sugars, right? Basically sucrose. They're already part of the way, converted for you. You're picking possibly the worst thing, because if you look at so those are simple sugars. Then if you string them together in a polymer, you have a polysaccharide. We can digest some polysaccharides, starches. Mm-hmm. The hardest polysaccharide to digest really is cellulose, right? This is why only, I think, termites and a few other weird insects have some microorganism to do that. But I think what you're saying is you're choosing this one because it's the bulk of the plant, tons and tons of cellulose, everything, even the sugar cane. Much of the sugar cane is the stalk and the cellulose. There's probably more cellulose than there actually is sucrose in sugar cane, sugar beets, these sorts of stuff. So how do you tackle such a challenge?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, all this cellulose is potentially very efficient to use, but the problem is cellulose itself, the way it is locked up in plants, makes it very difficult to get at.
Right.
And the
right.
word we use for that is recalcitrance, like a recalcitrant child.
Right, right.
In
Much
other
like
words,
Bill,
the cellulose in plants, plants are recalcitrant to being unlocked.
So stubbornly reluctant.
So what's
to
the,
want to
what
get
are the procedures that you go through to, almost like an industrial process? So let's say you've got that the stalk that and the cobs from the corn that you made ethanol out of the kernels. What do you do? What's the step
typically
number one?
People are not really using corn for this. Promising plant would be switchgrass, for example.
Okay. Okay.
You can grow that on wasteland, and it grows very densely and quickly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can that's very efficient switchgrass. Now, what you have to do though is once you've harvested your switchgrass, we would mix in one way of doing it that we're studying is to mix in enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two procedures to this. There are two processes. One of them is to hydrolyze the cellulose into sugars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hydrolysis.
So that's using just
fermenting the sugars into alcohol. Now, the fermentation of sugar into alcohol in East Tennessee, we are very good at that. Yeah,
yeah. Bill's very expensive.
High up in the Appalachian Mountains,
right.
There are these stills and so
right,
on.
Right.
They're experts. That's very easy, the fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the hydrolysis, it's the breaking the cellulose down into sugars that's difficult. So what you have to do is pre-treat the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you pre-treat them, there's research being done into how to do that, but you can heat them up you can add acid to them, maybe sulfites to them, and chemicals, mm-hmm. and try and make them into a mushy stuff that would help us get at the cellulose.
And that's the technical term, mushy stuff. Mm-hmm.
Mushy stuff, that's right.
That's an acronym, actually.
Yeah, I'll give you another technical term, if you like. The mushy stuff, the problem with the mushy stuff is it's got gunk in it. Gunk is a technical term.
There you go.
Then we have to get rid of the gunk to be able to get at the cellulose.
And chemically, what is the gunk?
Well, firstly, pre-treatment's expensive. Yeah, this is the problem. You know, to heat something up costs energy, and so we need to somehow find ways that require less pre-treatment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for example, one of the standard pre-treatment regimes that one does with switchgrass, you know, if you look at it afterwards, after you've pre-treated it, you peer into it to see what's happened to your mess in there, the mush, you find there's gunk that's stuck to the cellulose, and mm-hmm. this gunk is called lignin. Another major plant. So the lignin kind of re-precipitates mm-hmm. back onto cellulose fibers and really gets in the way.
And what is lignin?
So lignin is a common polymer that you find in plant cell walls, and it's important for mechanical strength in plants and also water conduction naturally.
Now, does it have sugar moieties in it?
Not quite, no, but okay. it has things called, it's a polymer made of monomers, that are monolignols.
Mm-hmm.
There's some research being done into using lignin as well as a biofuel, breaking it up, but that's a separate subject.
Well, I guess my question is, have you learned anything from, you know, because you talk about the fermentation point, and there are plenty of people skilled with that in the hills of Tennessee.
That's right, yeah.
But the folks that know how to break up cellulose into hemicellulose and lignin, and they deal with that lignin sticky problem all the time, are the paper folks. I mean, and you know what they do? They just put a lot of alkaline sodium hydroxide in it and wail on it for a while, and that's how they do a Kraft pulp. Do you do anything like that, or are you trying to take a more fundamental approach with, say, enzymes?
You are getting beyond my
we're engineers.
There.
Yeah, so we're thinking about the old-fashioned way, where they just pour a ton of sodium hydroxide.
Yeah, what we're trying to do ourselves, well, firstly, we have, I don't know if you remember, President Bush created, he gave the money to the Department of Energy to create three bioenergy centers in the U.S. This was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the center that we work in.
Mm-hmm.
There's one up in the Great Lakes, one at Berkeley, and one that's centered at Oak Ridge but has a large participation from Georgia Tech and UGA.
Mm-hmm.
And we were thinking of what to call this Center for Research on Bioenergy, and we thought that WOW would be a good idea. WOW.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whiskey out of wood. But, you know, I think some people thought the Department of Energy wouldn't really appreciate that acronym, so it's called BESC instead, the Bioenergy Research Center.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of BESC is to try and understand what recalcitrance is. Recalcitrance of biomass of mm-hmm. these plant cell walls. What is the recalcitrance?
Right.
Where does it come from? And how can we engineer new plants genetically that are less recalcitrant, and maybe new enzymes and microbes that can come in and efficiently hydrolyze the cellulose.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds,
that's the point of that.
Yeah, it sounds to me that, I mean, the approach you're probably taking different than a lot of the paper companies, and I've worked with some of the paper companies, they take a very empirical approach of, you know, how can we change this balance of this chemical to that chemical, whereas what you're doing is you're looking fundamentally at the bonds inside cellulose, right? The bonds inside the sugar, the bonds that connect the sugars together. In fact, that's what you're doing with the hydrolysis, right? You add water to it, you break it into the individual sugars.
So let me kind of try to get some basics across here. So hydrolyze is hydrolysis, so it's using water
to break
in the presence of water. It can basically break these bonds up.
Mm-hmm.
And cellulose, if you could break up these bonds, is sugar. Is that correct?
That's right, absolutely.
Yeah. So if you can
now,
do that
unfortunately,
part...
Unfortunately, though, if you just mix water with cellulose, nothing mm-hmm. happens for a very, very long while.
Right, right.
So you need a catalyst
mm-hmm.
to do that, to speed up this use of water to break mm-hmm. up cellulose. And
Got
those
it.
Are those tend to be enzymes, cellulases. These enzymes will do it.
So if you're looking at, so cellulose is sort of sugar with some interconnectedness that makes it so that we can't digest it. So as much as I might try to get some nutrition out of chewing on a toothpick, just not going to happen. One thing you brought up genetically engineered. I mean, why not be able to use the waste, so to speak, from crops like the cotton plant, corn plant, all these soybean plant. Once you've gotten the bean or whatever out of the soybean, if you could convert all that mass. First of all, what's the best case, do you think, for the percentage of the original plant mass that you could convert to ethanol?
Well, I mean, the best case is to do it all, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And all the cellulose in there, that's what we're aiming for. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what's in the way. Imagine you're a little enzyme now, cellulase enzyme, and enzymes, once you've produced them, you can use them again and again and again, in principle. So that's okay. And now I'm coming into a plant cell wall. The problem is the following. Is there's these lignin and hemicellulose polymers in the way. So if you imagine the cellulose, which itself is fibrils, crystalline kind of fibers, and the cellulose is coated by this sort of disordered network of polymers, and they get in the way. So the enzyme can't reach the cellulose.
Got it, okay.
And then when it has reached the cellulose, imagine you do get through somehow, the cellulose is in this sort of tight crystalline form, and you have to pull apart the strands of cellulose from each other in the fibrils. So it's very much a physical, mechanical problem here, this recalcitrance.
And so goes beyond. If you just sort of put this in a shredder, like Pete does with most of his documents after he creates them.
I am required to do that by law.
Yeah. Is that enough?
I think if you have a really expensive shredder that could shred things down to minute sizes, then it might be enough. But these are expensive to do. Expensive. We want to do things like any of this.
So it's not like just chopping.
It's
not like just chopping it up and you're done. You still haven't gotten to the molecular level of the enzymes being able to attack those bonds between the.
Mechanical chopping is part of the pretreatment process. Right now, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But by itself, that wouldn't be enough.
It depends kind of how you do it. I would think if you could chop things up very, very, very finely, it might be enough.
And these fine fibers, right, they're still not individual molecules. I mean, this is literally what gets put down on a felt when you make paper. So they chemically break it into that, but you still have a lot of hierarchy to get there.
Yeah, the cellulose fibrils are made of strands of cellulose.
Yeah.
And the strand is just one polymer chain. So if you can pull the strand apart, in fact, these enzymes, they're beautiful things. Mm-hmm. They're the cellulase enzymes. They're made by microorganisms that themselves want to break up cellulose and create sugars for themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And the cellulases, they come in a variety of forms, but typically they'll have something called a cellulose binding module, which kind of clamps onto the cellulose strand. Yeah. So imagine this clamp that nature has designed, and then somehow, we don't know how, we want to find out, it'll pull the strand out, the enzyme will, and then eat it up with the catalytic part. So they're very beautiful things.
Mm-hmm. So that's the level that you're looking at this for?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Now, could you use microbes directly, or is that not really the efficient way to do this?
That's, I believe, this bioenergy science center that we work in, that is their fundamental philosophy, is to try and use a microbe directly to do the hydrolysis into sugars and the fermentation into alcohol. Yeah?
Okay.
That's the goal of what we're doing.
Okay.
Right. But to put it in perspective, I mean, as I said before, you've picked the hardest one. I mean, all these polysaccharides, they're different, you know, things, glucose, fructose, mannose, galactose, whatever it is. And then they're arranged in different things. You can glue them together in different structures. So, you know, starch and other things, even we can digest. But the one that's the hardest, and it's a good thing because it's what makes wood in a tree trunk. Mm-hmm. You don't want trees dissolving, right? And mm-hmm. wood's a great material for us. Unfortunately, it's the most common one, but it's also the hardest thing to do. So enzymes are the key? Would that be a fair statement?
That's one way of doing it. Okay. There are other processes, too, that people are looking at, but enzymes produced by microbes, what we're looking at. And although, you know, this is a hard scientific problem to overcome, cellulosic ethanol, I believe, is already commercial, yeah? And it's already being produced to some, in a way that's competitive with fossil fuels.
Right. Now, in
what we're trying to do is improve the process.
So where is it being used commercially, and what's the process that's commercially viable?
Well, I'm not aware of, I don't want to say anything wrong here, but certainly switchgrass is mm-hmm. being used, I think, commercially to produce ethanol, which is just the same as any other ethanol. Yeah? And so you can then put that in grassoline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Grassoline.
Oh, I like that.
Grassoline, as they call it.
You will be pleased to know.
It doesn't work in English, that. Grassoline doesn't work in England.
What is it? Harry Croteau did say that the key was to come up with a snappy name for any discovery.
Yeah, he came up with the Buckyball.
The Buckyball. So, yeah. So grassoline, you are grassoline. Carrying on that
and
fine tradition.
Why wouldn't that not work in England?
Well, but the pronunciation doesn't work. Grassoline. We don't say gasoline anyway. We say petrol.
Right.
Oh, okay. So we go, what are you talking about? Okay, right. Got it. Okay.
So have you discovered anything interesting with regard to this enzymatic process that might be exploited to improve it so far?
Yeah. I mean, what we, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, we are, what I like doing is playing with big toys.
Mm-hmm.
And Oak Ridge National Lab and the University of Tennessee have got big toys, big computers.
Mm-hmm.
We have the world's most powerful computer at Oak Ridge, and it's called Jaguar. And it works at more than a petaflop, it's called. That's the speed of the computer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something like 1,000 million calculations per second is what it can do.
Right, so for our computer geeks out there, you know, megaflops, floating point operations per second, that's 1,000,000. Everyone talks about gigabytes of memory now. You can have a gigaflop, then comes the teraflop, then comes the petaflop. So
that's right. So there's only a couple of machines in the world that can go up to the petaflop.
And even bigger than that is the Tom Cruise flop.
Sorry. And people that like petaflop machines, mm-hmm. they would be a petaphile, which is an unfortunate name.
No, that's where you store the data from the petaflop, is in a petaphile.
So let's do this.
This is a very powerful machine, Jaguar, you know. It has shown itself capable of predicting the winner of the 2009 Knoxville Rubber Duck Race from the Big Bang in less than 2 seconds.
Which is almost as important as cellulose.
Did it outpredict
that? I borrowed from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, did it outpredict the octopus who was picking the winners in the World Cup?
Yep.
Is it more accurate than that?
That's right, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Jeremy Smith about the use of the big toys, these large computers, as well as the neutron source out at Oak Ridge National Lab, to understand how they can improve this enzymatic process. And if you've got a question or comment about producing cellulosic ethanol, by all means, give us a call if you're listening live Wednesdays noon to 1 here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
The library on the radio, I told you it would work.
It does work, but we need a cool theme song.
Hit it. Lost in the Stacks is the one and only research library rock and roll show right here on WREK Atlanta.
Fridays at noon, your hosts Amit and Charlie pick a theme and free associate an hour of music, interviews, and library talk. You'll hear indie rock, pop rock, alt rock, new wave, and the occasional oddity in between interviews with students, faculty, and librarians. Whatever you tune in for, we hope you dig it.
Turn that back up.
Where silence spreads.
Tune into the Overnight Alternatives every weeknight from 1:30 a.m. to 6 a.m. for the most extreme music you don't hear on the radio. Each night, that's 4.5 hours of musical exploration, spanning from conventional musics to the farthest reaches of noise, free improvisation, and experimental composition. Once again, that's the Overnight Alternatives. Expand your perception of what music is every weeknight from 1:30 a.m. to 6 a.m. right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta. Your true home for quality, diverse music.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Jeremy Smith from the Oak Ridge National Lab and the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, about using big toys, the Jaguar supercomputer and the Spallation Neutron Source at Oak Ridge National Labs, to figure out how to turn cellulose into ethanol. If you've got a question or comment about this topic and you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1, by all means, give us a call at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468.
Or if you have a plant or somebody that you would like to convert to ethanol.
You're number one on the list now, Bill.
I know, that's all I'm saying.
Okay. So
what do you, with the computer, what is it that you model? What is it that you try to do? What do you work on?
Well, we want to understand what recalcitrance is of this biomass of these plants. We want to understand what the origin of the recalcitrance of biomass to hydrolysis is. And for that, we need to a physical model. We need a picture of what a plant cell wall looks like. And we also need to know things like if we pre-treated it, what happens then? What are the processes that go on? And so what we've done is we've built models of cellulose fibers at atomic detail, with each atom explicitly represented. Mm-hmm. And then the atoms interact with each other. There are forces between the atoms which make them move. And so we then build up trajectories of each atom in the system through space as time goes by.
Mm-hmm.
So that's called molecular dynamics. That's the simulation technique. And we do that now, you know, with the Jaguar and the University of Tennessee Kraken supercomputer. It's a monster supercomputer, which is also at Oak Ridge, and that's the...
Did you say Kraken?
Kraken is
the Greek mythological
beast.
It's the fourth
most powerful computer in the world.
Oh, it's so not like a crock of moonshine?
So no, like, no us Americans say okay. Kraken, but we know okay, what you're talking okay. about.
Oh, Kraken. Okay. You see, I'm saying Jaguar like the Americans do.
Right, it's supposed to say Jaguar.
Jaguar.
Yeah.
We
Jaguar.
Like the British Jaguar. That's good.
Can I say Jaguar from now on?
You can.
You certainly may.
Feel free to, yeah.
So the Jaguar and Kraken, that's right.
Right.
Okay. Kraken is a sea monster. It's a monster computer.
Right.
Okay.
And the University of Tennessee, they give us a little bit more freedom on that than we get with Jaguar.
Uh-huh.
So what we've done then, we have this these systems of millions of atoms with, you know, the cellulose and the gunk as well. If you remember if I talked about gunk?
Yeah.
That's lignin. And we do these simulations to see what happens, you know, if you've stirred everything up, what happens to the system. So we can watch the lignin aggregating with itself and then precipitating onto the cellulose. And we've done that. So to try and figure out why this happens, what are the fundamental reasons that you get this precipitation with a view to being able to change the process later.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you understand why it's sticking, this might lead towards if you have a fundamental understanding on how you can keep it from precipitating.
That's right. Now, our experimental colleagues, who are very important in this, that they are... They will provide us details of what kinds of lignins they're looking at right now, this may affect things, or whether we can use some kind of solvent that would stop things from sticking together. And the other thing we're trying to do is to figure out how these enzymes work. You know, the enzymes,
right.
The cellulases that digest the cellulose. So for that, you need actually quantum mechanics to do that, to understand chemical reactions that the enzymes undergo. So those are other calculations. Again, with an idea, if you understand how the reaction happens, how the enzymes accelerate the hydrolysis reaction, then maybe we can get a handle on engineering better enzymes themselves.
Wow. So what is the neutron scattering used for?
Okay, neutron scattering, that's an obviously an experimental technique. It's not simulation anymore. And, to put it very simply, there are some things we can see with the naked eye in science, but when these things get to be very small, when they get to be the sizes of atoms and molecules, then, of course, we can't see them anymore. And we need something that will be our eyes for us. And typically, the eyes that scientists use, well, they're electromagnetic radiation, such as X-rays and infrared and things like that, or maybe electrons. But neutrons themselves are a very, very powerful use as eyes to see molecules with. And the reason they're powerful is they don't have a charge, and so they're very penetrating, and they bump off nuclei, atomic nuclei. So when you bump a neutron into a molecule, it just hits the nucleus, so you can find out exactly where the nucleus is. Mm-hmm. And because neutrons are not electromagnetic, they're not photons, they exchange, they have mass, and when they bump into molecules, they will exchange a large fraction of that incident energy with the sample.
Mm-hmm.
So that means the thing that you're looking at, the atom that you're looking at, you can figure out where it is and where it's going, structure and dynamics at the same time.
Ah. So how do you, so the input is the neutron beam, what's the output? More neutrons and analyze
the output? The output is a scattering pattern or profile. It depends what type of neutron scattering you do. There are many different types. In Oak Ridge, we have like about 20 different instruments which are used. You know, the neutron beams go into the instruments and they do different things. Some of them look at structures, such as cellulose structure. Others look at motion, such as, you know, how these enzymes move as they're approaching the cellulose. And so you can find all this out by looking at scattering profiles of how the neutrons get bumped off the sample, which angle they get scattered into, and what energy they have.
And so there's probably got to be some computation there as well to sort of back out of that scatter pattern what it means, right?
Exactly. So, you know, the reason that I came over to wildest Tennessee from Germany was because, you know, we have these supercomputers at Oak Ridge, and also the neutron scattering is to combine the two.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is to use the most powerful computers that we have to produce the most accurate models we can of the systems, and then use those models to interpret neutron scattering profiles.
So and why don't you use X-ray crystallography, for example?
Well, we do. It's very important and useful. Mm-hmm. And X-rays...
Well, what do you get different? That's really my
question. That's right,
question,
okay. So X-rays and neutrons are very complementary to each other.
Mm-hmm.
X-rays are easy to produce. You can produce X-rays just on your kitchen table, you know?
Mm-hmm.
With the right stuff.
Right.
But neutrons, you know, they require expensive sources, such as a nuclear reactor, or in the case of Oak Ridge, a so-called spallation source, which is another expensive piece of equipment. But once you've produced the neutron, it can be very complementary to X-rays. X-rays interact with electrons, in other words, with the outsides of atoms, whereas neutrons interact with the nuclei. And so this produces fundamentally different information.
Now, do you have to have a crystallized sample to have the neutron scattering?
It depends what you're looking at. Say we want a protein structure. This is one of the things that X-rays has produced many thousands of protein structures over the years. We cannot produce a protein structure at atomic detail just with neutrons. But if you already have an X-ray structure, what you don't get with the X-rays is the positions of the hydrogen atoms. And they can be crucial because they can determine the active site of an enzyme and exactly how it functions. But neutrons, because of the way they scatter, you can see the hydrogens with them. So if you do an X-ray experiment, say a crystallography experiment, to produce the protein structure, and then you do neutron crystallography, you then get a complete picture, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the ways that neutrons is complementary to X-rays. And you then stick that in the supercomputer, and you try and understand everything.
And is that purely due to the fact that I mean, they call it the scattering power in radiation, but the effective scattering cross-section of X-rays to hydrogen atoms is essentially zip, whereas it's a better ratio for neutrons?
That's right. And it's zip because there are not many electrons in a hydrogen atom.
Yeah.
But neutron scattering depends on esoteric properties of the nucleus, how much it scatters.
Okay. I learned something new.
Yeah.
And therefore, neutrons will scatter strongly from hydrogen.
Okay.
And that's one of the uses of it.
So when you put all this stuff together, have you learned anything recently about how what direction? I realize this is a very long-term project, right? It's not going to be like when George Bush talked about we're going to be making ethanol out of switchgrass.
We're going to be on the moon next week.
I mean, anything that's pointing in the direction that you want to change the enzymes?
Not so long-term. I mean, some of the work we've done in BESC, in particular with Steve Brown here, has already produced bugs that have become tolerant to acetate, which is one of the products of this. So we're already doing well. Concerning the supercomputing neutron scattering, what we've done recently is to figure out what lignin actually is, what the structure of lignin is. The electron microscopists had pictures of lignin bound to cellulose where the lignin looked like kind of balls, round balls. These little white balls it looked like on the electron micrograph. And what this combination of neutrons and supercomputing has just shown is they're not white balls at all. What they are is what we call fractal objects in three orders of magnitude of length scale that are highly folded. So we know you got to go now from the concept of white balls to the concept of this sort of highly folded surface, which is the same over three orders of magnitude, looks exactly the same, with water penetrating into it and with a fluid outside and a rigid inside. So this conceptual advance that we now have as to what lignin looks like is going to be incorporated in the way people think about overcoming recalcitrance.
Well, and I would think the paper guys would be very interested in your research, actually, because this impacts what they do.
Yeah, we hope they will be. In fact, paper research is, I think, closely related to what's going on at Georgia Tech and University of Georgia and what they're doing with our center.
Right.
Well. Yep. All right, well, we've reached the end of the program where we like to cover the topic we call What Have We Learned? I know I've learned a lot. Let me take a crack at this, and then, Jeremy, feel free to chime in if Bill and I don't cover anything. So today we were talking about work that came out of one of the three, what is it, bioengineering research centers. Or bioenergy research centers, right. So this is one at Oak Ridge National Labs as opposed to the one in the Great Lakes or the one at Berkeley. And basically what you're looking at is finding a way to break down the most common, you know, aspect of almost every plant, cellulose, and it's overcoming this recalcitrance, this stubborn desire not to be turned into ethanol on the part of cellulose. And I guess you mentioned George Bush was actually right, that switchgrass is good for this. I thought he made that up when I heard him say that. That's good to hear. Can you use it for kudzu, which is big down here in the south?
Can we use it for what?
For kudzu, that annoying plant that covers all the trees and things like that.
Oh, I know what you mean.
Yeah,
why not?
Yeah,
there you go.
Maybe that's the plant that I'll try to set up.
At last, a useful use for kudzu.
Right, and basically what you guys are doing is using neutron scattering to figure out the exact details of cellulose and in particular lignin to figure out how you can attack it, get it to break down.
By understanding where the hydrogens, even though you can't see them with X-rays, are going to have a big impact on how the enzyme works. So it's important to know where those are.
And then and let's call this a complementary approach, is to not only use Jaguar, this petascale computing platform, along with Kraken. I like Kraken because that means in the office you can say, release the Kraken. Yeah, that's always a good job if you can do that. You know, I like those Greek mythology movies, what can I say?
Can I threaten my graduate students with Kraken?
I think you should just scream out, release the Kraken, and that should do it.
Yeah, have them just run. Yeah.
Right, so that's not
I think in a broader sense, that if this all works out, there's the potential to use the kudzu, the waste product from, or you know, the stalks from cotton, soybeans, all that to create fuel, and you know, there'd be a lot of fuel there.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, because the amount of your raw material is huge.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But basically, by using neutron scattering to get the structure of these materials and how they work as they break down and things like that, as well as modeling them so you can see the specific picture and help interpret the data, you guys have actually come up with some breakthroughs. You've actually figured out more or less how lignin is, what its morphology is. That's that shape. You talked about this fractal dimension of things, that maybe it's more porous. And I'm telling you right now, the paper guys would find that great. You said this has led to producing bugs that can handle acetate better, right? So this is a byproduct. Yep. So basically, they can live in vinegar better, right? Because,
yeah,
I mean, you
know,
right. the acetate ion and the acid ion, that's basically vinegar, which is really important. I mean, we think about that. In fact, a couple weeks ago, we talked about brewing and the race to brew the high alcohol beer.
Right.
The limit is the fact that alcohol kills the bugs that you're talking about.
Right.
Then hopefully, you know, if this happens, this will have a huge change on the landscape of how we produce energy.
Right.
Only because, I mean, cellulose just doesn't come from the stalks of corn. It's trees. Mm-hmm. It's everything.
Right.
And then eventually you'll be able to produce lovely products like gasoline, at least in this country.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be called something else over there as well. And it all sounds very promising. And then, of course, what I learned is now that I'm in my 40s, I should be looking into joining a Wohngemeinschaft over there in Germany. Because that's what us old guys do. Did we leave anything out?
No. What do you think, Jeremy?
That's fine. Yeah. I've enjoyed being on the show.
Great.
Well, thank you
so
very much for coming on the show. If you've got a question or a comment or a suggestion for a future program here on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.